We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. No job this morning. He's off...
doing whatever job does occasionally.
Occasionally he does. He has to go back and get reprogrammed. So we hope that goes well. All right. So covering what went on this last week, starting with local and... couple items about the arena, new lawsuit.
Yeah, there's a new lawsuit was filed this week in King County Superior Court to try to halt the construction of the third arena in Soto. It's on behalf of one of the sponsors of Initiative 91, which voters passed, I think, back in 2006. There were three other plaintiffs in the lawsuit, too. It charges that the arena agreement that was made between the city, the county, and hedge fund manager Chris Hansen for a construction of a new arena to try to lure back an NBA team to Seattle, charges that arena agreement violates the terms of Initiative 91, which said that the city must make a profit from any public money put into any kind of new sports facility or arena. The suit also says that the arena agreement violates the state constitution, which prohibits local governments from giving or loaning money to a private company. So it really kind of touches on the reason for Chris Hansen going to the city and the county and saying, I need you to kick in about $200 million to help me finance this arena. In fact, he doesn't really need that $200 million. He has plenty of money himself. What he wants the $200 million or what he wanted the $200 million for is so that he can take that money and then go to a bank and say, hey, look, I got, you know, $200 million from the city and the county. Can you give me a cheaper loan? So it's really so that he can help lower his own interest rates. And the lawsuit points that out. It says, you know, the city, the public is not going to get fair value back on this money that it's essentially loaning to this loan that it's making to Hansen and his partners. We're not going to be making a profit like Initiative 91 specifies, and it really boils down to just an unsecured construction loan. By unsecured, what they mean is Hansen doesn't have to put up any collateral. Usually when you go to a bank for a loan, you have to put up some kind of collateral, whether it's proof of your annual income or whether it's a list of your other assets that you own. You have to put up some collateral to get that loan. Well, Hansen doesn't have to do that in this case. The agreement says that he and his partners don't have to put up any of their personal assets to back the $200 million that the city and county are giving them. So this new lawsuit follows on the first lawsuit, which was filed by the ILWU several months ago, that charges that the city and county signed on to the agreement without doing a full environmental impact statement or looking at any other alternative sites to put the arena other than in Soto on the site that Chris Hansen owns. So and that site actually is probably the only piece of collateral that Hansen has put up for the city and county loan. He's basically said, well, you know, if you kick in this money, we'll pay it back over the 30-year lease of the arena, you know, and you at the end of the time, you know, at the end of that 30 years, the city will own the property and the arena. Well, this new lawsuit charges that piece of property is not worth the $200 million that's being put up for construction of the arena. And at the end of the 30-year lease, the arena itself is not going to be worth, you know, 2 cents, much less $200 million.
Yeah, probably be knocking it down by then, replacing it with another.
Yeah, probably sooner than 30 years.
Mm-hmm. All right. So... in addition to that,
there was some more evidence this week that Chris Hansen and his partners aren't really in this deal to make any money. There are lots of rumors been going back and forth over the last couple of weeks about Chris Hansen and his partners being in negotiations to buy the Sacramento Kings. And there hasn't been much confirmation of those rumors, but it seems that, you know, rumors like that generally don't exist if there isn't something beneath them. And one of the things that I noticed from all those rumors that really stuck out for me was that Hansen is supposed to have made an offer of $525 million to buy the Sacramento Kings, which for folks who follow the sale the purchase and sale of NBA teams. $525 million would be a record amount to pay for an NBA team. And in fact, about a year ago, Forbes magazine listed in January of 2012 what it thought the actual value of NBA teams were. And when it listed those teams, the value that it gave for the Sacramento Kings was about $300 million, which, if you'll notice, is about $252 million less than what Chris Hansen proposed to pay for them, if that's true. And when you look at that, you go, and you know, looking at that list that Forbes did, only three teams were above the $500 million level, and all the rest were below that, and most of them, including the Sacramento Kings, well below $525 million. And so when you look at that, you have to ask yourself, was that a well-considered business proposal to buy a team for almost, what, 75% more than what they're really worth? You know, is he just making a bid to try to outbid all comers, you know, and say, here, we want this team so badly, I'm willing to pay this huge premium for them, for this vanity team that I want to have to play with. So it makes you wonder, the city and the county have entered into this agreement thinking that Hansen's a serious businessman. You know, he's a rich hedge fund manager. He knows how to make a profit, right? And he will make the arena make a profit and he will make the team make a profit. Well, I'm not so convinced. And I think looking at that proposal, if that amount is really the amount he bid for the Sacramento Kings, I'd have to say, no, this is evidence that he's not really in this to make money. And that if 5 or 6 years down the road, the team doesn't make enough money and he and his partners get tired of pouring money down that hole, then the city might be stuck with an arena that isn't worth very much and no team to fill it.
And they're not really into using the arenas to house the homeless.
No.
As we've seen.
No.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
All right.
Let's move on.
Well, speaking of lawsuits, another lawsuit this week regarding the King County Sheriff's Office.
Yeah, there was a lawsuit filed on Thursday against King County by the three veteran female detectives alleging sexual harassment in the King County Sheriff's Office. Now, we talked about this story a few months back when the three female detectives came forward and made the charges that they had experienced gross sexual harassment as detectives working in the sexual assault unit, or I guess it's called the special assault unit at the King County Sheriff's Office. And they had named three sergeants in particular who were senior to them in the unit. And they had not actually filed the lawsuit then. They were threatening to file a lawsuit, but they had made these charges because they were trying to go through the process for dealing with sexual harassment issues in the King County Sheriff's Office. They were trying to move that process forward. And even though they've been through that whole process, they haven't gotten any kind of action on it from the King County Sheriff's Office or King County in general. So now they've come to court to try to see if they can get King County to make some kind of changes. The two sergeants that were eventually named in the lawsuit are Sergeant Anthony Provenzo and Sergeant Paul Malam. Both are accused of making derogatory comments and creating a divisive and almost intolerable working environment for female detectives on the unit. And that quote comes from the lawsuit, but not from the three female detectives. It comes from a male detective who is one of six other current and former members of the unit who have come forward to support the allegations of the three female plaintiffs about the special assault unit. So it really, of those six current and former employees, I want to point out that three of them are female and three of them are male. So not all male members of the special assault unit are the problem here. It's the guys leading the unit, and there were at least three male members of the unit who were totally disgusted by what was going on. So it makes you wonder, too, what's going on at the King County Sheriff's Office. First, with issues of the King County Sheriff's Office not dealing with public complaints about abuse and misuse of force by King County Sheriff's officers, and not being responsive to requests for information and now not being responsive to its own detectives saying that there are problems within the department. I think with the FBI looking into what's been going on at the Seattle Police Department, maybe they ought to be also looking into what's going on at the King County Sheriff's Office.
Well, and didn't we just have an election with a new sheriff being put in there?
Well, yeah, but the new sheriff has, you know, experience having worked for the King County Sheriff's Office before. So, you know, it's not like you're getting totally new blood in there.
Right.
And sometimes replacing the guy at the top doesn't always mean that there are going to be changes going on down below. And sometimes it takes a much bigger look, a much deeper look to make a real shakeup happen.
All right. Transportation-related items this week.
Yeah, we had several, excuse me, several transportation-related items this week that happened. There was some major transit news. Community Transit in Snohomish County says that it wants to increase ridership by 25%. But, you know, that's kind of hard when you don't run any buses at all on Sundays or holidays. And they recently cut service by 37% to say that you want to increase ridership by 25%. That's going to be a little bit hard when you're reducing service. Pierce Transit, on the other hand, has announced that they will cut service by at least 34%. They say that they're going to have to eliminate all weekend and holiday service, eliminate some routes, and cut service after 7 p.m. Now, King County Metro recently made some cuts, although they announced them as expansion in service by saying, well, they kind of snuck in the cuts by saying we're doing these new rapid ride routes that will provide more service to customers. Well, it provides a little bit less service actually to people along those routes where the new rapid ride buses go, because those rapid ride buses, as it turns out, are replacing multiple bus routes that have been cut. And King County Metro, under that announcement, also has made cuts to their service after 7 p.m. and that has been a disaster for people who have to rely principally on the bus system to get around. Not having service after 7 p.m. means that if you don't get all of your work and all of your shopping and all of your errands done before 7 p.m., you're pretty much stuck standing in the cold waiting for a bus for half hour, 45 minutes.
I know those Pierce County proposed cuts come in addition to them just having, I think, in the last year done about a 30-something percent cut.
Yeah, so, cuts on top of cuts.
Yeah.
That's what's been happening.
It's devastating.
It is. It's really bad for particularly elderly people and the disabled folks who can't drive and who have to rely on the bus system. If you're stuck all weekend someplace, that can be pretty bad. It can be really terrible. Particularly if you're an elderly person and, you know, you're not paying attention to what day of the week it is, maybe, and you have to go get a prescription refilled. How are you going to do that if there's no bus service for 2 days?
Yeah.
That's tough.
All right. Other transportation-related items?
Yeah. The City of Seattle Department of Transportation issued a new report on their road and bridge maintenance. And, you know, they have to look at this about every year or so to estimate what the backlog is and try to prioritize what projects need maintenance. And the report was pretty grim. It showed that the city has a backlog of $1.8 billion in repairs that need to be made. And it said that the city should be spending about $190 million a year in order to catch up on that backlog. Currently, the city spends only about $40 to $50 million a year. That's about one quarter. That's only one quarter of what this report estimates needs to be spent. So this is why we're falling further and further and further behind. One-third of the city's bridges, according to this report, one-third of the city's bridges are candidates for complete replacement, and 10 are, quote, structurally deficient, end quote. For example, on a scale of about 1 to 100 points where they rate the sufficiency of a bridge, the Magnolia Bridge ranks at just under 18 on that scale of 1 to 100. Yeah, and you know, the Magnolia Bridge has been, they've talked about it for a long time as one of the many bridges in the city that's going to need eventual replacement. I think anybody looking at that would say, why didn't we replace that a while ago? So clearly, you know, the city has to do something. And I would say, personally, my recommendation is that the city stop spending scarce transportation dollars on vanity projects like the Mercer Corridor and the things like the South Lake Union Trolley and expanding the trolley system, and start spending it where it needs to be spent on fixing the roads and bridges that really desperately need repairs and replacement.
All right.
And in other transportation news this week, too, the Tunnel Advisory Committee. A lot of people don't know this, but not only is the Washington Department of Transportation studying tolls for the new downtown traffic tunnel, but there's a 15-member Tunnel Advisory Committee that's supposed to be helping them figure out how to manage the new downtown traffic tunnel to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct. The Tunnel Advisory Committee released a report this week on tolls for the tunnel, and they came to pretty much the same conclusions that WashDOT did. They said that no level of tolling will raise the $200 million in funds that are supposed to help build and maintain the tunnel. Now, $200 million, I just need to point this out at the beginning here, $200 million is half the amount that was originally estimated that tolls would be able to collect for the tunnel. Originally, the estimate was $400 million when the plan was sold to voters, and that when voters voted for it, they assumed, okay, tolls will take care of $400 million. Well, no, now that amount's been cut in half to $200 million. And even then, these studies, first the WashDOT study and now the Tunnel Advisory Committee studies, are showing that no level of tolls, whether you put it at 75 cents during off-peak hours, which was the lowest range of tolling that they looked at, or up to as high as $3 during peak times, no level of tolling is going to collect $200 million. And, you know, and when they looked at that 75-cent rate, the low rate, what they basically said was, they admitted what critics of the tunnel have said all along. Nobody's going to pay even 75 cents when there are free roads and streets to take instead. And that was essentially what they said in their study that they released. But, you know, they're undaunted. They're going back to the drawing board and they're saying, well, we'll look at other tolling scenarios. We'll look at a toll that's as low as 45 cents, you know? And you look at that and you just go, look, tiny tolls are not the answer. You know, you're not going to be able to charge people 45 cents and be able to collect $200 million. It's not going to pencil out. Tiny tolls are not going to do it. What it really comes down to is you're either going to have to build it with no tolling at all and just find other sources of revenue. In other words, new taxes for the residents of Seattle to pay for this boondoggle. Or they're going to have to start tolling every north-south corridor, including I-5 and 405. And that's not going to be popular either.
Pay people to use the tunnel.
Yeah, and you know, pay people to use the tunnel. It really points to what Jav and I and other critics of the tunnel were saying early on. You know, don't build this hugely expensive thing that doesn't even have any exits into downtown. Just build a surface street, build a surface corridor that people can use, and don't toll the dang thing.
All right. Anything else on transportation?
No, let's move on.
All right. Pam Roach making a little, or getting in the news this week.
Yeah, State Senator Pam Roach is in the news this week. She had, back in 2010, was accused of verbally abusing a Senate staff member, and the Senate Facilities and Operations Committee back then slapped sanctions on her, saying, well, we don't want you to have any contact with Senate staff people because we don't trust you to treat them fairly. Pam Roach didn't like that, but she had to comply with the committee's ruling. And then as recently as 4 months ago, they reinstated the sanctions. They reaffirmed the sanctions, saying, we still don't want you to have any contact with Senate staffers. But the new coalition of 24 Republicans plus two Republicans who call themselves Democrats in the state Senate decided that they needed to have they absolutely realized they needed to have Roach's vote in order to make up a majority party in the Senate. So they put pressure on that committee, and the committee lifted the sanctions. even though new allegations have surfaced recently that she abused yet another Senate staffer in March of 2012, soon after she was allowed back into the Republican caucus to cast her vote to support that Republican-backed budget bill, which narrowly passed back in March of 2012. So she's been accused of now verbally abusing another Senate staffer. And she's also been accused of verbally abusing another senator as well as a Senate staff person. And the sanctions really weren't supposed to be lifted until Roach had completed counseling. But, of course, she hasn't gone to any kind of counseling or anger management classes. And as recently as this Thursday, she called a press conference in which she said, quote, "I never mistreated anyone." End quote. So she's in complete denial, thinks she's done nothing wrong. And now not only has the new Republican majority in the Senate lifted the sanctions against her, they named Roach the new chair of the Senate Facilities and Operations Committee, which is the committee that was originally tasked with disciplining her. So not only did they lift the sanctions, they put her in charge of that committee. So, yeah, it's a comedy of errors here. And sadly, it's going to leave the state Senate. It's going to leave the state government and the Republican Party open to lawsuits by saying, look, you guys knew that she flies off the handle and that she's abusive, but you put her in charge of the very committee that's supposed to deal with those issues. That's leaving you open for some serious liability problems. And in fact, when she was reinstated last March for that budget vote, the original staffer who she was accused of abusing in 2010 filed a lawsuit. So that's not just funny or sad. It's also a problem. And it's going to make this legislative term kind of interesting to see what happens.
All right. Let's dive into
national
and President Obama coming out this week with a plan for
gun control. Yeah. He announced his plan for dealing with mass shootings like the one that happened at Newtown. He had four legislative proposals that would include reinstating the assault weapons ban and hopefully strengthening it. The assault weapons ban was in effect from 1994 to 2004. It lapsed in 2004 and hasn't been renewed by Congress since. He's called for a renewal of that. He wants to ban the sale and production of magazines with more than 10 rounds, close the loopholes in the background check program, including for sales, private sales at gun shows, and he wants to ban the possession and sale of armor-piercing bullets and the use of straw purchasers. That's people who can pass background checks who then buy guns and give them to people who can't pass the background check. And then he went on to nominate Todd Jones, the current acting director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, to formally lead the agency, which hasn't had a real formal head since 2006 when the current guy left during the Bush administration and George W. Bush decided, well, he didn't need to appoint a new head. And I just want to point out that the state of New York is in the midst of passing much stronger legislation than what Obama has proposed. And they're doing it with true bipartisan support. Their legislation is much more specific. Obama's proposals were, I thought, very vague. The New York legislation is much more specific and I think pretty clear. Their legislation would ban assault weapons that have detachable magazines and only one military-style feature. The old assault weapons ban from 1994 to 2004 specified weapons that have two military-style features, which allowed gun makers to make weapons with only one military-style feature that snuck in under the assault weapons ban and made it largely ineffective. The New York law would also mean that residents who already have those guns could keep them, but they'd have to register them. It would create a statewide gun registration database. It would ban gun magazines with more than 7 rounds, not 10 rounds, which is what Obama proposed. And it would require background checks for all gun buyers and for anyone who buys ammunition. So it's much stronger in many ways. And it's very, very popular in New York and has gotten bipartisan support even from Republicans who are for the Second Amendment. Now, this is at a time, too, when there's vast support across America for strengthening gun control laws. This week, CBS and New York Times did a poll on attitudes towards gun control. which found that 54% of Americans think gun control laws should be tightened, which is gun control laws in general. All gun control laws should be tightened. That's up from just 39% 9 months ago. So that's in response to what happened in Newtown. 9 out of 10 people support requiring background checks for all gun purchases, including private sales at gun shows. And 90% of people who have a gun in their household and 85% of NRA members are for tightening background checks. 6 in 10 Americans support banning high-capacity gun magazines. And 47% of respondents said 47% of all respondents said that they had a gun in their household, which is pretty representative, I think, of the American public. And, of course, of all respondents to the survey, 80%, of course, recognizing one of the major issues behind recent mass shootings, said that better mental health screening and treatment in general are needed. So I thought that was very interesting. That even though politicians can posture and say, well, I'm for, and the NRA can say, well, I'm for the Second Amendment, and any kind of strengthening of the laws means we lose our rights, et cetera, et cetera. Most Americans don't feel that way. They feel that there has to be some kind of reasonable control of these very dangerous weapons.
All right. And it just leaves us a few minutes left to touch on the foreclosure abuse.
Yeah, I don't think Job probably talked much about the recent settlement on foreclosure abuse, but about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, the federal government came to a settlement agreement with 10 of the major banks that they would pay about $8.5 billion to settle lawsuits over foreclosure abuse. Folks might remember that from about 2008 to the present, banks have been accused of robo-signing foreclosure documents and other abusive practices in pursuing foreclosures against people to whom they made abusive loans. And that $8.5 billion settlement, only about $3 billion will go in direct payments to people who were victims of abusive foreclosures. And that is pennies, literally. When you think about the number of homeowners who've gone through foreclosure, it's over 4 million people. If you're only taking about $3 billion and spreading it out among those 4 million people, that's a little less than $1,000 per person. And these people, remember, they lost their homes and all the equity in their homes. And that's going to amount to much, much more than you know, $800 or $900 that they're going to get in this settlement. So essentially, the settlement gave the banks a free pass for having first of all made these abusive loans to people, and then secondly just went ahead just swooping in and instead of working out a deal with them to pay off a reasonable amount of debt on their home, they swooped in and took the homes away from some people who were current on their payments, not just people who were behind on their payments. Some people were current on their payments and mistakes were made and their properties were seized. So that means those folks get almost nothing in this settlement. And really what was not talked much about in the settlement is that the federal government made it in order to hide the fact that they did a terrible job when it came to reviewing these foreclosure files, because in an earlier settlement, they had agreed with the banks that the banks would completely throw open their foreclosure files and let the government review them for abusive practices and decide, you know, a reasonable settlement for people. Well, what happened was the federal government didn't have the manpower to do that. So they told the banks, you can go ahead and hire private contractors to come in and review your files. And by the way, you will pay the fees for these private contractors. We won't. So, of course, the banks hired people who, you know, were beholden to them. And the whole review process was glacially slow, produced no settlements for the victims involved, and almost always came down on the side of the banks. So the federal government really scrambled to do this settlement. It was too little, it was too late, and it was to hide their having mishandled the whole foreclosure abuse process from the beginning.
And those bankers are still loose and out on the streets.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, I think they're doing some of the same abusive practices as before.
So we'll be able to see that on a television set soon. Talking as we do every week with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found online at www.eatthestate.org. And you can find more of my older material at mariatomchik.com.